It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk about flood recovery in the Cedar River Valley. Perhaps you're in that area recovering along the Cedar River or one of its tributaries that flooded within the last few days. In a few minutes, we'll talk about Cedar Rapids. But first, upstream to Cedar Falls, my hometown, where cleanup is underway after high water earlier this week. All residents have returned to their homes. Roads are open again. Ron Gaines is a city administrator for Cedar Falls. He joins me now with an update about the damage left in the wake of this flooding. Ron Gaines, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Tell us, remind us, what areas in Cedar Falls were hardest hit?
Our hardest hit areas were northern Cedar Falls, north of the river, up Center Street and up Lincoln Street.
Mm-hmm. So what is known as the North Cedar area?
Yeah, North Cedar area, and maybe to some people they might recognize the term Old Cedar City area.
Mm-hmm. Downtown area, how did that come out?
Downtown area fared very well. The elevation of our levee systems, the top of it is about 103, and the crest was at 98.9. So we did have sandbagging efforts, but luckily they weren't put to the test.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of the extent of the damage as far as you can survey it at this point.
We have inspectors out all week. They've been out looking at homes, and right now we're estimating that there's probably somewhere between 220 to 250 homes that would have some level of damage. That level of damage may be from, you know, a couple of inches of water in their basement to maybe 5 or 6 foot of water on their main floor.
Mm-hmm. And what options do the residents of those homes have?
Well, right now they're trying to get back in and put some of their lives back together. I know there's going to be a big volunteer effort to go help clean up some of those homes right now. You know, I can answer that question probably a couple different ways. The first way is, you know, we have a big volunteer effort that's going to help people clean those areas up. The city is also going to be up there starting Saturday and Sunday picking up some of that flood debris and whether it's appliances or drywall, sheetrock, that type of thing, and sandbags. So we'll be up there Saturday and Sunday picking that stuff up. Now, maybe a little bit of a different way to answer that question is, what are some of those options that residents may have? We're trying to work with the state and federal government to see what relief efforts will come. I know that we have had some buyouts in the past, and they may have that option at some point.
Mm-hmm. When we think back to the flood of 2008, do you feel that in your preparation here, you learned lessons from that flood to this one?
Yeah, I do. I think there was we had a really good response from the city. Unfortunately, we were able to react much quicker in the North Cedar area. But you know, it's still heartbreaking when you see how many people have damage to their homes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How many were evacuated in Cedar Falls?
As a mandatory evacuation, no homes were mandatory evacuated, but we did have our fire department go door to door, and what we were estimating the flood impacted areas would be just to warn people and let them know that, you know, the flood's coming and you really need to start mobilizing.
Mm-hmm.
The only area that really had a mandatory evacuation would have been the Western home, which they were moving their residents in. And what we were really concerned with is if we did get some of that overtopping of that area, that maybe some of their most challenging residents would be difficult to move.
And any personal flood stories that will stay with you for years to come based on this flood?
You know, there's not any one in particular that I could tell you. It's just when you go up to the donation center and you go out to those areas and people are just devastated, and anything we can do to help, that's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And any estimates on what this flood will cost the Cedar Falls area?
We're actually trying to put those estimates together right now. We've done a lot of infrastructure work with regard to our Center Street, Lincoln Street. There were some pretty bad washouts along that corridor with a major gas line that was kind of uprooted. Luckily, it's still intact, but Cedar Falls Utilities is going to be working to get that reinstalled. So between private and public, we're expecting there's going to be a it'll be a significant dollar. I would estimate in the millions. So.
Mm. Ron Gaines, thank you very much for the update. City Administrator for the City of Cedar Falls, we wish you and all the other residents of Cedar Falls and the area stricken by the floods the best in your recovery, Ron. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, talking about flood recovery. Now, moving on downstream, the Cedar River, after the heavy rains from last week, found its way into streams and rivers all across the north-central part of the state, northeast part of the state. The Cedar River in Cedar Rapids is expected to go below major flood stage sometime today. Cedar Rapids faring much better than it did the last major flood, in part because of the lessons learned from the catastrophe of 2008. Dean Borg is with me now in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
So tell us a little bit about, Cedar Rapids, of course, downstream, just getting below major flood stage today, hopefully?
Well, it's such a difference, Ben. Over the weekend, the tension was palpable. And among the city council, the other leaders in the community, residents really didn't know what to do because they remembered 2008. This time, as you've said, yes, they had the experience of 2008, but this time leadership and communication made the difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what kind of difference? More specifics. What were the comparison here? Were more residents out? Was more equipment out? Were more sandbags out?
Well, you know what happened in 2008, mm-hmm. and yes, all of the above because of the experience of 2008. This time, too. They had 4 days to get ready, but yes, we had last time in Cedar Rapids, we had a little bit more than 2 days to get ready. But this time, in 2 days, because of the lessons learned, they were able to put up 10 miles of HESCO barriers, sand-filled barriers. And that effort was led by Jen Winter, who is the Public Works Director in Cedar Rapids. Now, she's one of the few women in the entire nation who has a title like that, and that Public Works Director is just not a role that most women have gone into, at least yet. Jen Winter, yesterday, Mayor Corbett called her to the lectern where he was addressing a news conference, and complimented her, told about the leadership, and then he turned around and gave her a big hug. That was impressive in not only the hug, but she went to the rear then and sat down in the chair where she had been, and I looked over at her, and her lower lip was trembling. I thought she was going to begin sobbing. And here's what the reason for that, Ben. She had been under enormous pressure with very little sleep for days on end. And I think that little hug and the affirmation, job well done, just really brought her near the breaking point.
Mm, that's a wonderful story. You collected some audio out there as well. Tell us about some of the voices you're going to share here.
Here's a voice. There was a can-do attitude this time. It wasn't. And one of the voices, I think on Sunday, I was speaking with a woman who was moving with her husband, moving out of the apartment that they shared with a barber shop, a building on 3rd Avenue Southwest. And I asked her, you know, where are you going? What are you going to do? And here's what she said.
We're evacuating, just to be on the safe side, his mother's house. Nah, it could be worse. It could be a lot worse. The whole city could be wiped out, so it could be worse.
And you know what? She surprised me when she said, could be worse,
mm-hmm.
because I expected her to be whining and saying, oh, here we go again. No. And that was the attitude that just permeated Cedar Rapids, and leadership took advantage of that. People out, you know, piling sandbags, people all, they had nearly as many people out there as they have sandbags.
And these are people that have experienced much worse, most of them, and that had to be part of the reason she responded the way she did.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And so the leadership of the city council and the communication that they had, daily news, televised news conferences. People knew what was going on. Mayor Ron Corbett, Mayor Pro Tem Justin Shield, Scott Olson, and the other council people there, the police and fire departments, all in those news conferences every morning. People knew what was going on and made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people relieved that there was not so much damage on Tuesday on this program, Dean. I spoke with a business owner in Cedar Rapids who was not so lucky. Dave Owens, he's the owner of a business called Mad Modern, a furniture resale and restoration store in the New Bow neighborhood. Now, when you look at the map, the big HESCO barrier was, his business was on the wrong side of that. He was in water.
Jeff Pomerantz, the city manager, addressed that yesterday, and he acknowledged the fact that we had to make a decision on the advice of the Army Corps of Engineers. We had to make a decision as to where to put the HESCO barriers, and unfortunately for him, they put the HESCO barriers on the other side of his business, so he was taking on water. And the city manager, Jeff Pomerantz, said, we had to make a decision as to where these would go. We took the best advice. Those barriers had to be on solid ground, on pavement, and so that's where we decided and how we decided where to put those.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Ron Corbett, also a big part of this flood effort here, also speaking. I know you heard him speak as well about sort of longer-term recovery here in Cedar Rapids.
That's right, and Mayor Corbett's right. You know, we don't have in Cedar Rapids now the extensive devastation of 2008, but there are extensive, $4 to $6 million just in erecting the barriers, and the businesses, each individually, moving. Some people move their things to the top of the building using sky hooks and move them to the top of the buildings. But they also lost a whole week's of revenue in businesses.
Yes.
And Mayor Corbett was acknowledging that in what he said next.
And let me tell you why. After a disaster, oftentimes there's this federal money that comes into your town or state money that comes in your town to help your town recover and rebuild. That provides a stimulus. And that stimulus effect has a ripple effect or a multiplier effect in your community. Well, we're not going to have that this time. We're not going to have this stimulus from the federal or state government. If we're successful in getting any resources, it's really going to be for cost recovery of all the activity that's taken place.
There's another difference with the flood of 8 years ago in 2008. Dean, what else do we need to say here? I mean, longer term, how is Cedar Rapids going to better protect itself from flooding? This will undoubtedly occur. This is a rarer flood in the fall, but we have the spring just around the corner.
Well, that's right, and who knows what's coming next, except that Cedar Rapids has plans for flood protection. Some has already been done, but the federal money has not yet been appropriated for Cedar Rapids to finish the job. I think you're going to see now pressure on federal officials, congressional delegation and others, FEMA, to make an allocation and to get those flood barriers built in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm. Reflecting on this flood once again in the context of all the catastrophes, the floods that you've recovered, you've covered, Dean Borg, is there a memory you'll have of this one that sets it apart from other ones? What will stand out in your mind?
What will stand out in my mind is the fact that of the how eerie it was, with the bridges all shut, the sand barriers, and how eerie the National Guard, the state troopers out there patrolling. I was able, because with the media credentials, to get into that area with them, and how eerie it was to see that river flowing so swiftly and to know that it was far above the neighborhoods just on the other side. I'll never forget that feeling, because I remember 2008 being able to drive over I-380 and the bridge and look down on Cedar Rapids completely flooded.
Yes, I remember that too.
With water way up the size of side of buildings. here I was standing on the 12th Avenue Bridge, and I was looking at that river being contained. I'll never forget it.
Mm. Dean Borg, thank you for those images. And, of course, the city officials in all of these communities have to get ready for the fall and, of course, get rid of these sandbags because there will be snow removal needed before too long. All right. Iowa Public Radio's correspondent Dean Borg, thank you for joining us. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We talked about flood recovery in Cedar Falls and Cedar Rapids in the first part of our program. Well, as I mentioned, the Cedar River in Cedar Rapids is expected to go below major flood stage, 16 feet sometime today. Perhaps you have volunteered your time in one of the flood-stricken communities this past week, filling sandbags with sand. Hundreds of volunteers moving, I guess it's estimated, between 9 and 20 million pounds of sand, all bagged, all schlepped and stacked to form these barriers to protect property, businesses from the floodwaters in Cedar Rapids this past week. But what happens to all that sand when the floodwaters recede? Well, Aaron Jordan joins me now in the Iowa City studio, investigative reporter with the Cedar Rapids Gazette. You have looked into that question. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you.
So, all this sand, let's start up. Where did it come from in such short order?
Well, I thought it was really interesting. There are several quarries around Cedar Rapids that mine sand. Not all do. Not all quarries do, I learned. But so they got it, I think, initially from the Martin Marietta quarry, and then that quarry actually had to be evacuated because the water got too high in the river, because you have to be right by the river to mine this. So then they started getting it from the Wendling quarry. So they got it from a couple different quarries. It was all different types of sand, mostly fill sand, but also they had to move to some other types of sand as they ran out of the fill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happens now? So we have, what is the estimate, the best estimate you come up with, how many million pounds of sand we have out there in Cedar Rapids area now?
Well, the way we came up with that estimate is Jen Winter from the city had said that there were between 300,000 and 400,000 sandbags in use. And just looking online, the typical sandbag is filled 30 to 50 pounds. So, you know, depending on what end of that, could be like 9 million pounds to 20 million pounds. And, you know, all this sand, as Dean had said earlier, they're dropping it off. People and businesses are dropping it off in these sites. But then, you know, you got to get rid of the sandbags. So we've been kind of looking into that as well.
Mm-hmm. Is it then taken out of the sandbags? I don't know. One might think, oh, well, let's just save all these bags somewhere. We're going to need them at some point, right?
Well, it's interesting. I was talking this morning with Doug Newman with the Cedar Rapids Metro Alliance, and he said that they've been advised that people really shouldn't store the sandbags because the integrity of the bag itself degrades over time, so you don't want to save that for the next flood emergency. So really, they have to get the sand out of the bags, and there's some techniques you can use that are faster than manually doing each bag. I know in Manchester in 2010, when Lake Delhi flooded, they used is called a bucket. I'm trying to think, a sifting bucket, where basically it's attached to construction equipment. And they put the filled bags in the bucket, which basically churn it up with some blades. And the sand sifts out the bottom, and then they dump the bags. And they can do, you know, over time, millions of bags this way. But you know, that's one option. But Doug was saying he's also looked into something kind of interesting where they heat the bags to such a level that the bag actually burns up and it leaves the sand.
Hmm.
So I don't know, you know, what they're going to choose, what the expense is for all those different options.
Okay, so you have these millions of pounds of sand, and can it be repurposed somehow?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ways you can repurpose it. Sand that's been contaminated by floodwater, which in this case some will have been, some won't have been, it needs to be kind of dumped from the bags and spread out so the sunlight can kill any bacteria that's in it. But the Iowa DNR says that's okay to do. They are going to take some of the bags that haven't been emptied, and they can be used as fill under new developments. They'll be put as an underlayer with soil over it, with the idea that over 60 to 80 years, those will biodegrade. The sand itself, if it's loose, it can be used for just landscaping. It could be used on roadways, although I think the city uses different materials for that.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of volunteers, of course, and the city is grateful for all the volunteers that came out in the Cedar Rapids area to fill up these sandbags. And now is it de-bag? Is that the verb? Or unbag?
I don't know which word they use, but yeah, this is going to be another big effort, and I think the city is really taking on this part of it. If people can get the sandbags to the sites, the city is going to take care of it from there.
Mm-hmm. So that'll be going on over the next few days, because these sandbags, and we know from the flood of 2008, sometimes we had barriers up for weeks, didn't we?
Yeah, I think, different cities have left them up for different periods of time. But the businesses especially, and residents, you want to get those sandbags out of there so you can get the doors open to your business, you
yep.
can access your house. So I think the city is really trying to promote getting them dropped off.
Yeah, and we can't let it go too long. We're into the first licks of our fall weather, and we know what's coming after it gets a little bit crisp. It gets cold, and then we have snow, and then we have snow removal, and we don't want sandbags out there when that starts happening.
Definitely, and the city has definitely expressed that as well.
Okay. Aaron Jordan, investigative reporter with the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, looking into the question of what to do with all that sand. Thanks for clearing up a number of questions, Aaron. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Monday, the president of Iowa State University, Stephen Leith, said he will no longer pilot a university plane. He's used it for trips that have mixed business and personal affairs. Leith also said he and his wife will make a donation to the university's scholarship fund in the amount of costs associated with an accident he had with a plane of the university's in July of 2015. Here to tell us the story and its aftermath, Ryan Foley, reporter with the Associated Press. Hello, Ryan.
Hey.
So these moves by the ISU president, Stephen Leith, come after you at the AP reported last weekend that Leith suffered a hard landing in July of 2015. This is on his way home from an 11-day trip to North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about that incident.
Yeah, President Leith has said that he was returning from a personal vacation to North Carolina where he and his wife own a home. That trip also mixed a donor meeting that they had on one of the days. And they were stopping for refueling at the airport in Bloomington, Illinois, when he says the weather was changing quickly. Some wind caught the plane as he was landing, essentially, and he damaged the right wingtip by hitting the runway, and then he was off the runway, and as he was coming back onto it, he damaged the left wing flap when it hit a runway light.
Mm. Sounds like a scary landing. I've been in this is a four-seater that we have. I think it's a four- or six-seater. It's a small plane. In any case, it had a crosswind. Mm-hmm. And very scary landing, I'm sure for the president and his wife. But $12,000 of damage.
Yeah, $12,000 of damage that the university paid for. And additional, I think, over $1,000 in storage costs because this plane was stored in Illinois for about 10 weeks after the accident. And that's the $15,000 donation that Leith has now made to try to, make up for those costs.
Mm-hmm. What has President Leith said about this?
Well, he said, "I've done nothing wrong, but I won't do it again," more or less. He said that this was appropriate because they had some donor meetings. They had a donor meeting in North Carolina, and that he had decided to fly himself on one of the university's aircraft because he has a very busy schedule. He's making a lot of trips all over, not just Iowa, but all over the country, and it gave him additional flexibility. But now, to lay any sort of future safety concerns, he says he's no longer going to pilot the university's smaller aircraft.
Mm-hmm. How did this story come out? Because it's been quite a while since the actual incident.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just learned about it, basically, and I obtained the accident reports under the Illinois Open Records Law from the airport, which revealed the what it called the substantial damage to the airplane's wings. I think a lot of people in the Ames area, there's been some, talk about this, since shortly after it happened, but there'd never been any public acknowledgement or reporting on it.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're saying unless the AP had reported on this, the university, Iowa State University, was just happy to keep it on the down low.
Yeah, I think that's true. Leith says that sometime after, he has said that maybe a month or so afterwards, he told his boss, the president of the Iowa Board of Regents, Bruce Rastetter, about the hard landing. But at least one other member of the board says he was upset to learn about this from news reports and felt like it was inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. What does state law say about the conditions under which state employees can use state property, a plane, or there are plenty of state cars out there as well for this mix of personal affairs and business?
Yeah, it's really discouraged. Under both state law and numerous Iowa state policies. I mean, state law says that, you know, public officials cannot use any state-owned equipment or property for any private purpose or personal gain to the detriment of the state. University policies say, you know, warn people to be very careful when mixing any personal and business travel, and that that you cannot schedule travel in a way that, you know, is for personal gain. So, you know,
you have to pay attention to the spirit of it, not just the letter of the law, is perhaps what you're getting at there, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, scheduling. You know, I think it's an open question as to whether scheduling, a vacation around one donor trip would be an appropriate use of state equipment, state airplane in this case.
Mm-hmm. So any future repercussions or outstanding questions that you have as a reporter on this story?
We'll see. Stay tuned, I'd say. I think it does raise a number of questions about the university's purchase of these two aircrafts using private donations in 2014 at a cost of about $3 million. And how those aircraft have been used, whether it's a good idea for the university, which has had these planes for decades, but whether it makes sense in their current iteration to use them the way they are. So there's a number of outstanding questions we're all looking into.
Okay, Ryan Foley, thank you very much for telling us about how earlier the story behind the president of Iowa State University, Stephen Leith, saying he'll no longer pilot a university plane. Planes that he has used for trips that have mixed business and personal affairs. Ryan, we'll look forward to any of your further reporting on this or other stories. Thanks, Ryan of the Associated Press.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Iowa's largest comedy festival is happening this weekend in Des Moines. The Beast Village Comedy Festival is celebrating its third year in the state. Dan Umthen is with us, executive producer of Beast Village Comedy Festival, and he is also the self-identified cat herder in this venture. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being on. Now, for those who've never heard of it, tell us about this festival now in its third year.
The title of it was just a bad play on words. We started in the East Village, and we just called it Beast Village and have kind of played with it since. We've done this at a variety of different venues and in both the East Village and now this year. Our main shows are at Lefty's Live Music and Drake. We feature over 50 comedians from all across the country, and our headliners this year are Janelle James from New York and Ian Carmel, who's originally from Portland, now Los Angeles.
Okay. Why now? Why, 3 years ago you started it, but after all this time, why does Des Moines need a comedy festival?
Well, it's because when I had started doing stand-up comedy in the city of Des Moines, 9 years ago, there was one open mic that would happen roughly every 2 weeks. And it was great. It was really well run. The people who ran it were very passionate about it and made it the best thing that it could possibly be. And the scene of stand-up comedy has expanded since then, and there's so many more people doing it. And once we started seeing some of our friends and people who had started working and doing stand-up here leaving and moving to places like LA and Denver, Colorado, and New York. We felt like it was time to give people an incentive to stay in the state of Iowa, or to continue building things here, so that there's a world to continue doing stand up here, and also a good excuse to bring our friends who've made good in other cities back here, bringing back native Iowans to continue to build and make the scene thrive here. We think it's a very important thing culturally for the state. Because the stand-up, I think, gets an unfair reputation of being offensive for offense's sake or simply filthy, but I don't look at it that way at all. It never has been for me. In fact, it's very much the opposite. It's about people who are usually marginalized or oppressed having a voice and having a very powerful voice and being able to speak truth to power in a public setting in a way that they would never otherwise be able to. And it's through the use of humor that they're able to have their voice be heard and sort of accelerate or maybe become a catalyst for social change or just changing people's mindsets on, you know, what kind of burritos are the best. I don't know, depending on what their material is.
All right, Dan Umthen is with us, executive producer of the Beast Village Comedy Festival this weekend in Des Moines. You mentioned your headliners, national headliners, Janelle James and Ian Carmel. Let's listen to a little taste of Ian Carmel doing a very short segment of his stand-up show.
My girlfriend is way better at arguing than me. She's amazing at arguing. She can come up with these very eloquent ways to express exactly how she feels. Like, we'll be arguing, she'll be like, I feel like you don't even know who I am, do you? You don't know me. I'm just a book, and you looked at the cover. That's all that you did. You just looked at the cover. You didn't open up the book. You didn't read the table of contents. You don't know the plots or the storylines or the characters. But guess what, Ian? There's no cliff notes for my heart. Maybe you should crack open the book sometime. Maybe you'll read about something you love.
You're right. I'll get the groceries out of the car. I'm sorry.
Okay, Ian Carmel appearing this year in this year's Beast Village Comedy Festival. So does stand-up fall into different categories? You on the inside, do you have different boxes? What are the categories?
Absolutely. I feel like it's the same way with music. People have classical. They have punk, pop punk, country, rap, things like that. There are different subgenres. There's people who gravitate more towards a storytelling style, or more towards an absurdist style, or more towards a one-liner, like a pure joke writing style. Some people who are very observational, or tend towards like the slice of life, maybe more gentle styles of comedy. But all of those kinds of stand-up are well represented in this festival. And it's very much like a comedy buffet, which is another great American tradition. The buffets are a great American tradition. There's something for everybody.
Dan, on that buffet, what are your personal favorites in terms of style of stand-up? What do you do, for instance?
I vacillate between storytelling and writing just ridiculous one-liners. The comedians are also notoriously not very good at talking very positively about themselves, despite how self-indulgent a medium it is. So I'm okay at what I do, but I'm very much admire people who can write very tight, well-worded jokes. They're like Carlos Williams' statement about how poems are a machine made out of words. Well, jokes very much are so as well. It's a form of mind control almost, where you have a thought and you get someone else to think the same thing and make them have the same reaction that you did. It's incredibly sublime.
Ooh, that's sinister, Dan, to be practicing mind control. Now, you have the ears and we'll assume the minds of thousands of Iowans right now. Do you have a one-liner to practice your mind control on us?
Oh, dear. Let's see. Something that's radio appropriate, right?
Well, we would hope, yes.
Of course.
No, sorry, I put you on the spot there, Dan, but
yeah, I suppose you have.
We can come back to it. You can kind of turn that over in the back of your mind, while the front of your mind tells us about the overall comedy scene here in Iowa, not just in Des Moines. How have you seen it develop here in Iowa in the Midwest?
Well, it's grown quite a bit from what it was. There's now several comedy festivals in the state of Iowa. And it's grown so much from what it was, from there being just a smattering of a few open mics in larger cities like Des Moines and Davenport and Iowa City and Cedar Rapids, to growing where there's a large number of people doing this. I guess, boy, now that I really think about it, several hundred.
Several hundred in Iowa that are doing it. Several hundred.
Well, as an amateur or not yet professional level, there's probably a few that are making a living doing it. But there's a lot of people that I'm seeing that have come up, started learning sort of the essentials of the trade and the craft itself in Iowa, and then moved on to different cities. And so we're exporting a lot of our talent out of the state. And it goes beyond just stand-up. That wit translates to a lot of other things, not just telling jokes on stage, but that can be it can be theater, it can be other art forms.
Okay. Dan Umthen, we've run out of time. Tell us quickly how people can find out more about this year's Beast Village Comedy Festival this weekend in Des Moines.
Why, Ben, at BeastVillageComedyFest.com. Our two main shows this weekend are at Lefty's Live Music. Programming starts at 5 p.m. Both Friday and Saturday night. The whole weekend pass is just $25, or it's $15 for each day. We'd love to have you. Please come out. Thank you so much.
Dan Umthen of the Beast Village Comedy Festival, thank you so much. Finally, today we end with a note of remembrance. One of the key architects of building peace in the Middle East, attempts to do that, former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres, died earlier this week. He visited Buena Vista University in Storm Lake in Iowa in October of 1998. In a lecture there, he was asked if there is anything he could say to help the rest of the world understand the conflicts in the Middle East.
The Middle East, as you know, is rich in prophets and religions and ethnic groups and a great deal of wars and conflicts and divisions. It is the motherland of three of the major monolithic religions in our time, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. When one has a good look today in the relations among the religions, I believe more there is a competition in between one religion and another religion. Each of the religions is in confrontation with the New Age. They feel they cannot go longer the way they went. They cannot be as uncompromising, as extreme as they used to be. You know, politics is the art of compromise. Religion is the commitment of non-compromise. And unfortunately, where holiness begins, reason ends.
The words of Shimon Peres, speaking in 1998 in Iowa, words that are still relevant today. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.